try to do things, and it just doesn't work out the way I want it to.
Hello, my name is Tom Chick. You're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week we're talking about Repo Men. Not to be confused with the singular Repo Man, which of course is what that song is from.
Yeah,
see? I'm joined
That's
this
good.
Week by Christian Marsaski?
That's close. It's actually pronounced RZA.
I don't know what that's from. You don't have to explain that one. But first, I'm also here with Kelly Wand, who I hope has a tagline for us this week. Kelly Wand.
Yeah, a hysterectomy means never having to say you're sorry.
Oh, my God.
Let's go right back to you, Dingus. What was RZA? What was that?
Medicine. Medicine, medical theme.
Was that a reference to Repo Men, Dingus?
Wait, are we doing Repo Men?
Ugh, crap.
Yes, it is. It's a reference to my favorite performance in Repo Men. The character name being Jimmy T-Bone.
What?
Oh, RZA. I didn't know that's how you say that.
That's how you pronounce it. It's pronounced RZA.
Wow, you're really street, Dingus. Did you know that, Kelly Wand?
No, I still don't know who he's talking about. And I just saw that thing.
So the guy playing I guess is he Motown or whatever? Like I looked up who he was, and it was just capital R, capital Z, capital A. And
it's the guy. He's from Blue Tang Clan. What are you talking about?
From the Blue Tang Clan.
Oh, Blue Tang Clan.
Is that one of those fighting games that you play on the PlayStation 2?
No, you're thinking of Wu-Tang Clan 3. The first one was just a group.
Wow, okay, well, I did not know that.
I thought it was the Wu-Tang Guild.
That's how they play on WoW, but in real life they're just a clan.
So, Kelly Wand, why don't you break down for people who have not seen Repo Men, and for those of us who have and didn't really care what was going on, why don't you break down for us the events in this movie? Explain Repo Men to us.
Well, I just saw it, so it's all really fresh in my head. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's the future, as you can tell by the cars and the weather and the acting and the lighting. And there's this dude named Logan Five who kills people because a computer with a woman's voice tells him to do it, and he likes doing it, but then his crystal starts blinking, so now that it's him, it's not okay. So then he takes his chick and goes to the Lincoln Memorial, only it's a monkey now, because it's ape Lincoln. And then Cameron Diaz crashes the car because he called her his fuck buddy, and then he's back on Shutter Island after all.
Wow, that sounds like an interesting movie.
Except for you left out all the replicants.
Oh, right, yeah. Did I miss anything? I don't remember T-Bone Wu-Tang in it, though. I don't know who he's talking about. Is that Forrest Whitaker?
No. Oh my God!
Was this a Scientology movie disguised as a satire, a biting satire of the health?
I would characterize Repo Men as someone trying to do Brazil in the style of Blade Runner, and the whole thing not really working.
Right.
That would be my nutshell description.
With a twist. With a twist.
What twist?
Well, my audience, who I absolutely hated, thought there was a twist.
Well, the Brazil thing, you know, at what point is it all in Sam Lowry's mind?
Exactly, but the guy next to me was like, holy shit!
Didn't he see Shutter Island last week? This is the twist of every movie now.
Well, I think...
The island is never real, except, like that movie The Island, about the island.
That's literally about an island, yes, that's true.
Another movie this movie ripped off. When you're ripping off Michael Bay, you've really hit me.
Well, I want to ask you guys, was it clear to you the moment that Forrest Whitaker explains this, I think it was called MI5, is that correct? This neural net therapy medical scheme, was it MI5?
I think so, but I kept flashing to that British series whenever they would say that.
Well, MI5 is the British domestic intelligence, and MI6 is their foreign intelligence. MI5 is a division of the British government, so I remember thinking it was a little weird that they called this MI5. But the moment Forrest Whitaker explains this, I knew exactly what the movie was going to do, And I'm wondering if that was the case with you guys as well. Was anybody besides the guy sitting next to Dingus in the theater surprised?
I think my whole audience was surprised, but for me, as soon as he did that, I thought, okay, this is now either Chekhov's Repo Brain, or what do I have to contend with? Is the whole movie that? Are we the whole movie in his fantasy head, or are we going to get to a point where that happens? And then the moment it happens, you know, except for the guy sitting next to me and most of the rest of my crappy audience.
Well, I don't even see it that much as a twist, because I thought it was so blindingly obvious from the monologue about I've been knocked out 4 times in my life. I mean, this movie, first of all, calling this movie Repo Men was really stupid. If I was in charge of this movie, I would say, call this movie Knockout Number 5. And I just thought that all of that, I didn't even see it as a twist. It was just clearly, okay, at what point is the dream going to take over?
Right.
And maybe I'm just too smart for my own good. Kelly Wan, did you know that whole thing was coming?
No, I'm stupid. But I went, oh, yeah, same old twist. Like, I didn't see it coming, but only because I really didn't. I couldn't follow the movie. I was just having trouble concentrating on it.
It's got a really weird...
It made my eyes just slide away from the screen somehow, no matter what was happening.
Well, I think the second act is really drawn out and weird and should have been compressed a bit more. Or they should have done something else with it. I mean, it was just so predictable throughout.
Well, was it trying to be funny, though? That's what I really don't know. I'd like to know. Because it wasn't funny at all, and it seemed like it was set up to be this satire or something.
You know, I got the sense it was trying to be, though, like a sort of a subversive... I can imagine the director... thinking that he was making a Doctor Strangelove about healthcare.
But with badass slow motion Matrix-y action sequences.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, this guy's never done anything. I thought we established that last week. Wasn't he like some noob?
Yeah.
Well, he's done a lot of work with Danny Boyle.
Miguel Sapochnik.
In art direction. And so... I think this is his first thing that he's done.
It gave me that Sapochnik feeling.
Well, that's what the Sapochnik feeling is.
He was an art department runner on Trainspotting.
There. Yeah.
So that qualified him to make this biting satire.
And this was, of course, based on a Philip K. Dick novel, right?
No.
No?
What? What are you talking about?
I was just making a wild guess. I thought, that's a good guess, though, isn't it? Don't you think? Doesn't this seem like something based loosely on a Philip K. Dick novel?
Yeah, but, it was ripping off Blade Runner the movie more than, I don't know. You can't make Philip K. Dick too boring, and this movie was way too boring to be taken from a Philip K. Dick novel.
Weren't you really taken, Kelly Wand, by all the stuff about Schrodinger's cat escaping?
Didn't you ever hear that in any other movie? Well, it's good, though, because he actually does explain the concept of it.
And I don't even think he ever rolls out the word Schrodinger, which might confuse people like the guy sitting next to Dingus in the theater.
Yeah. The studio nixed that because they were worried it would confuse people.
Right.
Just make it a normal cat.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about who owns the cat. Yeah, he's got a long foreign name. That's going to alienate the audience. We don't want that in there. So let's go. So Dingus, what were some redeeming features of Repo Men? Go.
Did you say redeeming features of Repo Men?
You got anything? I have.
I've got a few redeeming features.
I have 4 scenes that I liked. I have 3 scenes that I liked and 1 that I really wanted to like.
I've got a couple of scenes that one scene I really, really liked, and then it was immediately ruined for me, and then it was redeemed for me when it turned out that what I suspected was going on was going on. And then there are a couple of things that I thought worked.
What?
I'm with Dingus, Kelly Wand.
What worked?
Well, first of all, I think the opening was much more promising than I was expecting it to be. The opening up until the whole thing with where he's doing the first repo, I think, and he's saying no need for violence, miss, and he's doing a lot of that was better than I thought it would be. I was expecting this to really be crappy and slipshod, and So up until then, I was like, okay, the opening's kind of promising. It kind of lost me after that, but I thought the opening was kind of promising. Mm-hmm. And I think that the found music for this movie, the music, not the score music, was good. Like the Crimea River thing was kind of neat, although I don't buy the relationship that it led to. I really liked the use of I'm just calling it found music, as in music people that you hear words to, as opposed to the Marco Beltrami score, which is just mixed horribly. But I thought the found music was really quite good and really moody and useful. And then, do you want me to talk about the scene that I really, really liked a lot?
Well, hold that thought. We'll talk about specific scenes. Kelly Wand, what were some redeeming features of Repo Men? Go.
The beach was well lit at the last shot.
So, Kelly Wand, I know you were capable of enjoying or appreciating slash enjoying crappy action sci-fi movies. Would this not fall in that category for you?
No, it's like Legion. The guy doesn't know how to do action. I don't like action where you can't tell what's going on. You're like cutting away from the money stuff.
Okay, well, let's then talk about one, because that brings me to one scene that I did like, and I'm curious if this would be in Dingus's list of scenes that he liked. And actually, we don't even have to talk about specific scenes, because I would say that as far as the action, I kind of appreciated this movie. I really enjoyed sitting watching an R-rated, violent action film, and I particularly liked the hall fight at the end on the way to the pink door, which I thought was – I was hoping was going to do an old boy style, no cutting, just one take of him working his way down the hallway with a hammer or whatever. I appreciated how dark and bloody and R-rated the fights were. So that hallway scene kind of worked for me.
Slow motion sucks. It's a crutch. I hate it. I'm sick of it. 300.
Well, I would agree with you, Kelly Wand. There were a lot of stylistic crutches here, but just because it's on crutches doesn't mean it can't walk.
Oh, nice!
And I don't know if you tell, I made that up as I was going. That's how fast I am.
So you're a limping apologist.
No, it sounded like you were doing that line on crutches.
There you go. Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. So,
what was your favorite line in that hall scene? Because I have one of my favorite lines in the movie is in that hall scene.
Give me the hacksaw now, stat!
That's not how he says it.
I don't remember any lines except for calling for the hacksaw.
And how does he do that?
Hacksaw?
Yes, yeah, hacksaw.
It's hack. Saw.
Well, he is British. He does tend to over-enunciate. So.
It's great that the hacksaw...
That is good.
Yeah, I've got one of those. Because for me, that whole scene is so weird. It's just so hyper-violent.
Well, isn't that one of his fantasies, too?
Absolutely.
Well, exactly, but you don't know that at the time. So it just feels like, for me, as I was watching it, it just felt like the gore level. Like we're in a video game, and this is the gore level, and everything's gory. And for what I don't know why we're in this level. Again, I'm sort of suspecting that this is where we are in the movie, but it's just great that this particular level of the film goes to that level of violence when you really haven't seen this level before. And I really liked the way that was shot, and especially when he goes, hacksaw. And why are you calling for a hacksaw? Okay, well, why not?
Because it doesn't do much. It doesn't accomplish much, and it certainly doesn't accomplish anything that one of his stray knives could have done just as well. I mean, two of the guys dodge the hacksaw, and it gets one guy on the throat enough to spray the wall with the arterial spray. But he could have done that with... with any sharp implement. Yeah, we don't actually see the impact on the flesh.
See? That's the money shot.
Well, when the hacksaw was being ordered, I didn't realize he was going to slash someone with it. I thought there was going to be an actual sawing scene. He was actually going to, a little back and forth on someone.
Right. He was going to steal their organs. Mess up the system. But I liked one thing where the little girl went, yay, when she took off the kneecap.
Okay, that was another scene that worked for me.
That scene did work for me. I agree with you. Because that scene worked, because that now it's kind of working on a funny level, too. That was one funny scene where I laughed.
You know what? You might be right, Kelly Wand. Like, as far as actually having some humor to its supposed bite, that might be the only scene where that actually happened.
Yeah.
Can you think of any other scenes that had that sort of level of humor that worked?
I can think of one that disturbed me and made me hate my audience. And that's when Peter tasers his mom and my entire audience cheered.
Peter?
Yeah, I gotta ask, who is Peter? Why? Peter?
Who's Peter?
When Remy, who is Jude Law, in case you didn't know, his name was Remy. When Jude Law's son.
Oh, the little boy tasers the mother.
Tasers the little mother, and my entire audience went, yeah!
Yeah, I don't think that was supposed to
be a shareable moment. Maybe it was, because Jude Law's kind of grinning at him afterwards a little bit. But the
kid looks shell-shocked. By the way, we should break down. Did he fantasize that, or did that really happen?
Well, that's clearly a fantasy scene. Otherwise, it's
we've all fantasized.
Otherwise, I want to kill everybody involved in this movie. That's a horrible moment. It's horrible. And when I saw it, I was just like, oh, come on. But the mother has been made into such a bitch. That the little boy tasering his own mother in order to comply with his estranged father's wishes made my audience cheer. Now, in a fantasy scene, that certainly makes sense, and it's very, very nice if you look at it in hindsight or if you understand it's a fantasy scene.
Right.
But given the idiocy of my audience, and I'll give you their opening quote of one of the doofuses seeing this show before it even started, later, but given the idiocy of my audience, they were not cheering because they knew this was a fantasy scene. They were cheering because a little boy had tasered his mother, who's a bitch.
But,
and that
right.
was awful.
You know what,
she wasn't a bitch.
Yeah, she wasn't a bitch, and I would argue she wasn't even a real character or a real person.
And neither was the kid. Neither of them were set up at all.
Exactly. At no point in the movie was either the kid or the mother, as Kelly Wand said, set up as an actual character, I would say. So...
I would find it more disturbing
if they were. But yeah, I agree with your sentiment, but I think it's expecting a little bit too much from the movie.
And the kid was all shell-shocked and glassy-eyed afterwards. Like,
I wondered about it. Was he Kelly Wand, or was he just a bad child actor?
Well, there's a lot of bad across the way.
Well, how do you know? He's playing a fantasy at that point. But he's playing a fantasy within sort of a hidden... I know you guys have both said this isn't supposed to be a twist, but it's clearly something that the filmmakers are thinking is a reveal at the end. So I think the film would have been more effective had they not been so consumed, as so many thrillers are now, with creating a twist for us. If they had set this up as this fantasy and let themselves go absolutely hog wild within it for the last... I don't know if you call it an act or demi-act of the movie, but instead they are sort of obsessed with hiding it from us until the Corona ad on the beach, and then they give the reveal, so the guy next to me says, holy shit, and so you have the actors kind of like the guy. Is he a bad actor? Is he glassy-eyed? Or is this within the fantasy? We don't know because they're hiding it from us.
Kelly, Dingus, I can't... So I'm going to be in an odd place here where I'm between Kelly Wand and Dingus. So Dingus, you're saying that it's supposed to be a twist. Kelly Wand, you're saying that you weren't bright enough to notice it.
Right.
My contention is that it's not supposed to be a twist. And early on, when they lay out so clearly, twice at least, this MI5 dream state therapy stuff, we know that that's going to happen. When Jude Law says, I've been knocked out 4 times in my life, and we see him get knocked out a 5th time, we know at that point that something like this is happening. I just can't help but think that the movie is that, and maybe I'm giving it too much credit, is that dense about expecting us not to get something so blatantly obvious.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but the way that thing is shot, where we come out and we see the replay of Forrest Whitaker smacking him on the head with the hook, And then you see the pullback of the MI5 device, whatever the hell it's called, implanted on his head. That is a reveal.
The reveal, Dingus, is when it happened, not that it happens.
No, no, no. I'm sorry to tell you, for you and I, that is true.
Okay, well, that's all I'm concerned about. That's what I'm saying, is for you and I, yes. And that's why I'm saying I'm in between Kelly Wan. Like, Kelly Wan, I think, granted, you said this yourself, Kelly, I think was a little too dense to catch on to it.
I really dumb myself down when I go into anything.
And you know what, Kelly Wan, here's why I think that is because I normally do as well. I normally don't pick up on things the filmmaker doesn't want me to pick up on. I'm not very bright. So I really don't think the twist was that he is dreaming. The twist is when it happens and when this knockout number 5 kicks in. I mean, all of that is laid so bare to me. I just find it hard to believe. And Dingus, you don't know for sure, and I don't know for sure. We could call Mr. Popinski, the director, and ask him about this. But short of that, I think this is an interpretive difference. You think the reveal that it happens is the reveal. I think the reveal is when it happens. I just think it's so obvious as soon as they're talking about this technology that's going to, you know, it's the gun on the wall. We know that that's going to get pulled down and used.
Well, I understand that, but you're talking about two different instances here. Now, you're going to have to lay it down. Now, are you saying that when
I'll lay it down like you never heard.
Hell yeah,
go
bitch.
Ahead. Lay it down.
Lay it down, yeah.
Talk some jive. And now, you're talking about two different things. You're talking about when they lay the groundwork for Chekhov's gun, when they give the little bits of advertisement early on.
Right.
Or are you talking about the reveal is when Forrest Whitaker actually hits him and he has those flashbacks? Which now say it. Which is it?
I don't understand what you're asking me.
Well,
I'm saying that it's not a reveal. The twist. You're talking about a twist.
No. You're telling me when the reveal is. So tell me when the reveal is.
The reveal of what, though? I'm disagreeing with you about what's being revealed. What's being revealed is when the movie shifts over to a dream state. I think it's pretty clear to anyone with a brain who's not Kelly Wand, and Kelly Wand, I'm sorry to keep bringing you up, but I think it's pretty clear to anyone watching that at some point the movie is going to shift into a dream state. What's not clear is when that happens. And that's the reveal, is when we find out that it happens with, you know, knockout number 5.
Yeah, and when is that reveal? When is the reveal that it happens then? Are you saying it happens on the knockout or happens later on after the Corona Beach scene when you have the pullback and you see the rod sticking in his head?
So you're calling it a reveal, but I think it's obvious that when he gets knocked out a fifth time, you're like, wait a minute. And then when you see that, you know, the glitch in the Corona ad scene.
I didn't know there'd be math in this movie.
it really is a simple matter of math, Kelly Wand. I really do think it's math. He early on says the number 4. We then see all 4 knockouts, and then a fifth knockout happens. I mean, that's math.
Well, in my defense, I'm not just dumb, but drug-addled.
Well,
so 5's a lot.
And probably, are you good at math, Kelly Wand?
No.
See? There you go.
Or podcasts.
So, Dingus, I think we're just...
Who won the argument just now? I wasn't really listening.
You did, Kelly, because you chose not to play.
All right.
I just want to get away from the parsing where the reveal happens, because I think we're talking past each other. And I want to get to what I think is more important, at least more important to me, and that is what in retrospect really ruined this movie, even having a shred of possibility for me, and that's how voiceover is used and how it is impossible in this movie.
Okay.
Well, no, if going by what Tom said, though, the voiceover is a clue, because there's a math clue buried in it, like a lost clue about the island lore.
Yeah, I mean, I don't.
When he says 4, that's part of this, that becomes important later, according to Tom.
Right.
So,
and I kind of like the script. I kind of like the fact that, you know, that the narrator was basically telling us. There's going to be a dream, you know, this movie's going to shift into a dream. But Dingus, so the voiceover didn't work for you for some reason. You said it was impossible?
Well, I like a lot of the voiceover, and I like Jude Law's voice, and I like some of the lines in the voiceover. I think there's far too much voiceover. But when we find out where the film has actually gone, as far as voiceover is concerned, we've got a narrator talking to us who can't possibly have related this story to us.
Kind of like Sunset Boulevard, you're saying.
Well, Sunset Boulevard, I think, makes an excuse, as does
American Beauty.
And that's okay with me. If a movie can sort of make an excuse for that, that's fine. I don't think this movie does. And I think given whose hands the memoir ends up in, I think that's whose voice you have to hear. And I don't think there's any excuse for hearing Jude Law's voice for this movie when you think about the rules of storytelling. And that ruins it for me. That ruins the voiceover for me.
You know, that hadn't even occurred to me. That's a very good point, Dingus. But before you talk about that, I'm curious – how is it that Sunset Boulevard and American Beauty can get away with it, but this one can't? Is it because this one has this great hook with the manuscript, and we should be hearing it from his son reading his manuscript?
That's a great hook.
Well, Dingus is saying that, I mean, it's an opportunity. I don't know about a hook. But Sunset Boulevard and American Beauty don't have that option. You know, the narrator's dead. He's talking to us from, I guess, heaven.
Or hell.
As the case may be.
Maybe hell's in the sky. Maybe we got it all backwards.
But the thing is, how is it that those are okay and this one isn't?
In one way, I think it's because, very simply, and I'll just deal with Sunset Boulevard, I think Sunset Boulevard is dealing straight with us. It's like, yeah, that's
ah.
And I appreciate that. Whereas the idea is that we're hearing a memoir. In fact, he says this is he says something like, this isn't just a creepy memoir. It's a cautionary tale, I think is his line. So I think it's clear that it's supposed to be the words of this text. And I think that when you get to the end of something, if the storyteller turns out to be somebody who couldn't have told the story, I have a problem with that. And I think that the person who could have told the story should be the one telling the story. That's and cool. I don't think this narrator could have told this story. Whereas Kevin Spacey and William Holden, given the structure of the narrative, the idea that somebody can be speaking to us from beyond the grave, and we're going to be upfront with that from the beginning, that's fine. But that's not what this film does. This film is more interested in cheating us. And this is where I'm sort of like, thank you, M. Night Shyamalan, or Planet of the Apes, or however back you want to trace the twist. It's like films are so impressed with themselves when they can give us a twist, even though you guys don't think this is a twist, that the narrative becomes weighted down by that, when they could have explored so many other ideas if they hadn't been weighted down by the idea of giving us a twist, which in this case I don't think even really matters and fooled the guy next to me and only fooled Kelly Wan because he willfully is able to go into a movie and say, I'm not going to pay attention to this element because I want to be
As am I, and that's why I think this movie is different. Is I'm normally exactly like Kelly Wan. Shutter Island got me. I had no idea. I have never seen an M. Night Shyamalan twist.
But now you're used to it, and you just saw it in Shutter Island, so it's already on your mind. You're already thinking, he's in the asylum.
I swear, seriously, anybody who sees this movie and hears Forrest Whitaker laying out this new MI5 neural treatment, you know, they even explain exactly how it works and doesn't see like a Vanilla Sky kind of thing in this movie's future. That's crazy to me. And Kelly Wand, I don't know what your deal is. I'm as slow as you. How did you miss that?
let's just be careful about how much we say about Shutter Island still, I think. But I'm sorry, but I had the same experience, Tom, that as soon as you see those MI5 things popping up, it is Chekhov's gun. It's like, oh, that's going to come later, and the only question is when.
Right.
And then by the end, I was thinking, is it the whole movie or is it a part of the movie?
But I think Dingus, you're supposed to be thinking that early on. I think because you don't just see the ads.
Schrodinger's cat is a tip off.
Schrodinger's cat, and you have Forrest Whitaker explaining how it works. You know, explaining the mechanics of it. So you know it's going to be important. I mean, I didn't mean to derail where you were going with this, but I don't think it's just like an ad in the background. It's clearly a prominent part of what's going to be happening in this story, I thought.
Well, I'll call it a story.
Well, I think that would be good because I think that Remy or Jude Law's line about how do they repo it he has this moment of where he's disturbed and he asks, how do they repo that? How do we get that thing back? Was a great little line, and it just blows right by you. But I don't honestly think that we're supposed to get anything more from those little explanations than, say, Life on a New World ads from Blade Runner is supposed to make us think that maybe we're on a new world.
It would be the equivalent of Gaff then explaining how the colonization of a new world works to Harrison Ford. You know, Life on a New World exists in the background as part of the scenery. But if then we had a prominent character then break down for us the mechanics of it, I would agree with you that that's a good analogy.
Harrison Ford.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
So I don't know. I don't mean to belabor this because Dingus, we're both right, and until we talk to Mr. Popinski, we have no way of knowing for sure.
What night are we getting him on the show?
I think he's on 2 weeks from now. Yeah. So let's talk about other things that did work. Here's what I wanted the second act to be, and there was one scene of this, and then they stopped doing it, and I was really bummed. I was looking forward to a second act about living in the wasteland with the bionic woman. How awesome would that have been? She had the super hearing. She had the, I don't know what she could have done with her knee, kicked really hard or something.
Yeah, why did she have so many fake parts?
I mean, I think that's the fiction of the world, is that people are breaking down and needing parts replaced.
Right.
But she didn't get caught for any of those things. Like, she had 9,000 different procedures done on all these different parts of her body. And I don't know.
She was a rebel.
If they made her too powerful to catch.
She was working off the grid.
I wanted that movie about being off the grid with the bionic woman, you know, having super hearing to head off all the other repo men. And what else did she have? I don't know what she could have done.
You wanted them to leave the domes?
Is that a Logan's Run?
Do you know what's, in the future, people still read books and type on manual typewriters.
Yeah, see? I thought that was cool. This whole back to nature thing. Or not nature, but back to the 20th century.
Steampunk.
Yeah.
Do you know what's incredibly cool about what you just said, Tom, about that idea?
The wasteland.
What just occurs to me is incredibly cool is that all while watching this film, I kept ticking off moments that it reminded me of Blade Runner. And what you just said makes me think that this film could have been the sequel to Blade Runner instead of what it is.
Sure.
So it could have been after they escape and how they survive and what happens to them. Because what you're describing is after, spoiler alert for Blade Runner, after they get away and when they try to exist. Staying away from Blade Runner / Repo Man.
Right.
And I didn't even think of that until you just said it. And that's a cool idea.
Well, and so much. I mean, this movie owes so much to Blade Runner. I mean, the production, Jude Law's haircut, for Pete's sake. You know, he had a Deckard coat. I mean, this movie was so enamored of Blade Runner.
Even his fight with Forrest Whitaker.
It's like a high school production of it.
Well, yeah, he gets thrown through a cinder block wall and smacked into the tiles of a bathroom. And it looks like the fight in Blade Runner with Roy Batty. It looks like that. And there's a lot of moments that look like and are clearly callbacks from the night shots of the city and the advertisements to what I just talked about. So from what you're talking about, to steal those moments I'm talking about and then launch into the sequel to Blade Runner would actually be an exciting movie.
And they you know, very briefly, you got her having the super hearing and plugging earphones in so he could hear with the big heavy footfall guy walking in. I was like, great, let's do a lot more of this kind of stuff.
But that was a fantasy, I thought.
That was, I think they, it's when they go back, was the airport stuff a fantasy? Because I think that was not a fantasy, Kelly Wand, because he actually goes out and writes his memoir. And then after then, I think they try to go, is the TSA / you know, carrying medics, was that fantasy?
No, I don't think so. I think that happens after that, after the landlord and everything.
Right, so that they go to the airport and then they go back out into the wasteland, and that's where Forrest Whitaker runs into him. Yeah, and the fantasy kicks in.
Why did Forrest Whitaker screw with his defibrillator paddles? I didn't understand.
So that he would not quit being his partner and go into sales.
Oh.
I thought there was going to be another layer of conspiracy going on there, and I was kind of relieved that there wasn't.
Okay, I'll tell you the other scene that worked for me. So I have Living in the Wasteland with Bionic Woman. I like that. I like 9-Year-Old Surgeon. I like the old boy style hall fight, even though it wasn't old boy style. So this reminded me of something that would be in a French horror film. And I know they wanted to go a little farther with it than they did. I wished they had. But the sexualization of that organ repossession in the chamber at the end, that had the potential to be really effed up. It kind of was. But not nearly as much as I think it could have been or should have been.
And it was a fantasy. It was a sexual fantasy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. See, there were good ideas, but they were badly executed.
I thought that one was fairly well executed. I mean, the gross stuff about opening up wounds and penetrating each other and him scanning, you know, sticking the scanner in her mouth. And it was kind of like, they both cared for each other, but it was painful and bloody, and that in another movie, in a movie that really had bite, would have been a really disturbing, effective scene.
That scene was exactly the one I was referring to earlier.
Go ahead.
The scene that I really loved that was immediately ruined and then redeemed for me. I thought it was beautiful, and thank goodness they had Alice Braga for that, because I didn't necessarily buy their relationship and wondered which one of them I would recast. But when they got to that scene, it really paid off. And I thought that scene was amazing.
So what was the ruination of it and what was the redemption of it for you?
Well, this is going back to something I complained about on an earlier podcast. About Edge of Night. I'm not going to say which scene, but it's something similar to this, where you go to all this trouble to do all of these different things, and then you resolve it by blowing something up or shooting somebody. And so they went to all this trouble to fool the machine, and then they resolve it by just exploding it.
Right. Which they're out of the system, and then they blow up the system.
And then he just puts in a couple of bombs. All right, great, fine.
Yeah, when they had gotten out of the system, they didn't need to do all the digging around, did they? That's a good point, Dingus. Yeah.
Well, see, I was lost with all the rules of that final scene. I had no idea what was going on. Why do you need an artificial organ to unlock the door? And why were they I was lost during that final part. I think Jude Law was just very confused about spinning out his fantasy and had no idea what was going on, so therefore the audience didn't either. That's my theory.
Well, knowing, going back, and what redeems it is going back and knowing it's a fantasy. So it's a fantasy, right. And it would be even more powerful, I think, if they hadn't already had a sex scene. I understand that you have to have a sex scene, but if they hadn't, the fantasy of going through his repo and making it sexual and sexualizing all of that is really powerful.
Yeah.
And it still works, but if it's all a part of a fantasy that's part of repression, especially given the way his marriage has been set up, it's even more powerful. The film sort of short circuits these things as it goes, but I really liked the way that scene is set up. He gets in, he looks at the table, he goes, "There's no keyboard," and then he sort of figures out what he has to do, and it's disgusting and weird and strange, and she's not sure whether or not to go along with it, and there's pleasure and there's pain and this goo that they spray on each other to heal, and then the two guys come in the room, watch, and then blow up the computer. I mean, it's weird. It's weird the way they resolve it.
So let me put a bug in y'all's head. I want y'all to imagine this movie had been directed by David Cronenberg, and what that scene would have been like then.
Hot.
So there were
more,
two
more instruments anyway.
there were two scenes that I think directors need to stop doing in this movie. And one of them, Dingus, you touched on how great that the organ repossession / sex scene would have been if it had been out of repression, if they hadn't had a love scene before. So the love scene they do have, and I hate this. I've had many, many first kisses in my life, and I don't think I've ever had one where it's me and someone from across the room just staring at each other, pause, 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 and then lunge and kiss. Those in movies, that is, I don't know about you guys. Has that ever been like a first kiss for you guys where you're just like hanging out and then it's just like smacking like right into each other? Does it ever work that way?
Only in the mirror.
But that's not how it happened here, actually.
Yes, they're standing across the it's silhouetted by the window. And I think she has just talked about he noticed her eyes and I think she had the line about her lips.
Exactly. She tells him to check her lips.
It's the only
like he just loves
her lips
better.
Are hers. All right.
No, but yeah. There's the pause, and then it's the stupid like movie thing where we're gonna have sexual tension, and then we're suddenly gonna break it, and so they have two actors like not be distant from each other, and then throw themselves into each other. I just think that's so clumsy and awkward.
It is clumsy and awkward. It's horrible. But for me, what it reminded me of, and she says, ask me about my lips, which sounds like a commercial. but it reminded me, it was a ripoff of a different Harrison Ford film, and that being the way it was done in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when he's pointing to his different...
But there's build-up there, right? But
yeah,
that has
exactly,
build-up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
this has no build-up.
Sort of,
the pause, lunge, kiss. There's no build-up.
You're right, but yeah. At least she said, ask me about my lips.
So he wouldn't have done it if they were fake lips, like braces.
I'm just relieved he went for the right set.
That was Kelly Wan's line.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Let's move on to the other scene that directors need to stop doing, and that is the scene of, it's the Stanley Kubrick shot of Jack Nicholson at the door of the freezer in The Shining, where it's somebody leaning against a door that they can't get through, and the camera is down underneath their face looking up. You guys know the shot I'm talking about?
Yeah.
They need to stop doing that. Just put a moratorium on those scenes. Because they have that with Forrest Whitaker at the end when he realizes that for some reason they need an organ to unlock the pink door.
That's like saying Tarantino should never do a car trunk point of view shot.
But see, that gets ripped off a lot. And when I see it get ripped off, I'm like, okay, if you are going to remind me of that Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, it's Reservoir Dogs. It's the cop in the trunk.
It's both. It's all.
It's Jackie Brown, too. Oh, right, right. So anytime a movie does that, I'm like, okay, if you're sure you want to remind me of Quentin Tarantino, if that's what you want in my head while I'm watching your movie, you better be sure that that's what you want. So when I'm watching Repo Men, and near the end, Mr. Popinski, the director, wants me to think about The Shining, I'm like, okay, if that's the comparison you want to invite, nice work. You've just taken me out of your movie and made me think of something that you will never be that good.
Right. Well, no, he wants you to think. He's just stealing it, hoping you won't notice that he's stealing it.
No, he's not. See, I think he knows. He knows I will notice. Like movie.
They haven't seen Blade Runner. This will blow their minds.
But I hate seeing that shot gets used all the time. Not all the time, but I hate seeing that shot in a movie that isn't even really trying. There's just any time a character gets to a door he can't get through, he's going to lean the top of his head against the door and look down, and the camera's going to be there shooting up at his face, leaning up against the door.
So. Well, what's that signify?
It signifies Jack Nicholson going crazy in the freezer and Shelley Duvall not letting him out. Hmm. And I don't know why you want to do that at your pink door.
Your pink door. I love that movie. That's the other thing I liked about the fact that the hall scene turns out to be a fantasy is that when he's going in, you see signs, pink door, that way.
Well, see, thing is, and that's where I think, I don't know, maybe it's just me. I'm like, okay, well, yeah, this is his fantasy, of course. And even where he, you know, strips off his shirt and he's got the two knives and he looks super badass, I'm like, well, yeah, this is his fantasy fight scene. But now here's another weird thing that took me out of it. So he is obviously having second thoughts about killing innocents. You know, he can't bring himself to cut open the people whose organs he needs to repossess in the wasteland in order to make money to save himself. But yet, when he comes across three guards standing out front of the building when he needs to get at the end, he tasers two of them and then shoots one of them in the mouth with a gun.
Repeatedly.
Like, he's all about, you know, I can't take lives of innocent people.
But they're guards.
I guess so they asked for it? I mean, that scene was really weird.
They worked for the union.
He tasers two of them, and then the third guy, he throws the taser at his head and bonks him on the head. So I'm like, okay, that's three non-lethal kills. But then there's a very gratuitous up-close shot of him shooting the guy in the mouth with the blood spraying out the back of his neck.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell? What? You know, I thought you were all about not taking human life. And
that's how random this whole movie is. Like, that would be a key moment, like a key character moment, like, oh, it's the first time I shot him in the mouth. But
exactly. Yeah.
The director just went, hey, just shoot him in the mouth. We're out of tasers. Next for the day. Just get it over with.
I mean,
that's why I wish we would have had the fantasy sequence or the dream time be something that we all knew about so that we could see, where is this director going to go? Where would Tarsem have taken this type of scene? Where would we go if this is in his fantasy or his mental world? You know, where can these types of things go? I'm not talking about just running off the walls like we do in The Matrix, but where can this movie actually go if we're going to be in a fantasy world? And unfortunately, even though they have a scene where Forrest Whitaker sits down and actually tells him the rules about things, we don't understand the rules for the MI5 world. Can it be anything his mind imagines, or is it all controlled by guys in a control room, as is implied? And why would it have to be that? Why does he have to be sitting on a beach in a Corona beer ad instead of, you know, having sex with a unicorn or something?
What the heck?
Sorry, did I?
Projection.
Yeah, geez, dingus.
We can edit that out, right?
No, unicorns are...
all right.
Hey, did you guys catch the Star Wars line in this movie?
You know what? I had that as a question. He did not say what I thought he said during that fight. And was it because the guy had a, like, mechanical hand? I could not believe that. I was like, get that out of this movie. I was sure it was a different line, and I just misheard it. I was going to ask you guys about that.
Well, it's not your fantasy, because apparently it's been confirmed.
Oh, my God.
What was it? I don't remember what you're talking about.
Forrest Whitaker's fighting the dude with the mechanical hand, and they're grappling, and he says, the force is strong, Luke, which I don't even think is a correct line. Like,
it's not.
Did he say that in Star Wars?
I don't remember that part. I must have been out of it. I don't
remember. You remember when they find the nest, and the two of them go into this ship? And
I thought that was a Battlefield Earth line said by Forrest Whitaker. Say what? We said...
You remember when they go into the ship after they found a nest and they have a bat, you can call it 12, 11, or whatever, and they go and they start fighting guys and it's fighting level? You remember?
Yeah, vaguely. Well,
Forrest Whitaker says exactly the line Tom says. He's grappling with this dude with a mechanical hand, and he says, the force is strong, Luke.
So the Star Wars movies are still relevant in the future. Wait, this wasn't a Fox movie, was it? Maybe it was. I guess they have to make them. Hey, Dingus, what did the doofus in your audience say?
Yeah, what was the opening quote before the movie started?
Oh, good one.
Way to forget.
Okay, before the movie even started, some guy a couple rows down from me, and the theater was pretty well packed. Some guy said, oh, I hope there's a lot of breasts in this.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, feet apart, and I'm free, getting down with 3 feet.
That's a good place to break, yeah?
It's such a softball.
Because the more breasts, the better. If you have, like, 100, it's so much better than just 2.
Then we just get a crappy, I think, club scene.
But that's what you can do in an R-rated movie, is have actual strippers in your crappy club scene.
I thought it was rated MI5.
Well, this week's 3x3, moving on from Repo Man. We could bag on Repo Man for a while, but I'm so done with that stupid movie.
Really? I feel like we gave it short shrift.
It deserved it.
You know who gave it short shrift, Kelly Wand? The paying audience this weekend.
Did your audience like it, either of your audiences? Because mine was dead silent the whole time.
Yeah, no, mine was not too into it. Dingus's guy must have loved it, though. He got a couple of breasts. He got a twist.
We had plenty of reactions in my audience. That's why I hated them so much.
Well, that's part of the movie-going experience. Huh, guys?
That is.
Okay. The redirection mambo.
This week's 3x3. This one's mine. I want 3 MacGuffins worth remembering. We talked a little bit before. A MacGuffin, of course, it's something in a movie that the good guys are chasing and the bad guys are chasing. They're both very involved in getting it. It matters to them, but to the audience, it doesn't really matter what it is.
Wait a minute. That's not how you described it last week.
How did I describe it last week?
I don't know, you gave a bunch of highfalutin Alfred Hitchman quotes.
Well, Hitchcock had a story about how the MacGuffin is a non-entity, how the MacGuffin doesn't really matter. But that's clearly, like, in a thriller, in an action movie or whatever, the good guys and the bad guys are chasing something. It matters to them. It doesn't matter to the audience what it is. So normally a MacGuffin is a throwaway thing. Now, the examples that I gave, I think it can matter.
Especially with the examples Tom gave.
Well, the examples I gave, so these are off the table, are the suitcase in Pulp Fiction,
plans to
the Death Star, the Ark of the Covenant, and I think the alien in the back of the Chevy Malibu and Repo Man.
My number two now.
I mentioned those last week, so I think
you
those
mentioned Repo Man, did you?
I think I did, yes.
All right.
But if you want it. We called him on it, and he mentioned it.
So if you, you know, and MacGuffins normally, it's not a definition that's in stone. So if you guys need to be flexible, that's cool.
Who was the original MacGuffin it was named after?
It's the story that Hitchcock told that I related about.
Right. But I wondered if that term was from a dude's name.
Yeah, it's Scotty MacGuffin.
Scott MacGuffin.
Scotty MacGuffin. He was
on Freaks and Geeks. Yeah. Right.
So let's see. I think, Kelly, you go first because you will be doing this week's 3x3. So what is your number three MacGuffin worth remembering?
My number three MacGuffin worth remembering is the Maltese Falcon because it's fake and really doesn't mean anything. So it's like the sled in Citizen Kane. Only avian and Maltese.
I can't follow that movie for the life of me. So what was the deal with that bird? It's a bird statue, yeah?
Yeah, but it's a fake, too. So that
it's not really a bird. It doesn't fly.
It's not a real bird. It's not actually from Malta. And, it's in the title, so you know it's going to matter, but it's not even in the movie because the one that's in the movie is a fake one.
Now, are there secret plans hidden inside of it?
No. There's nothing in it, and it's not real. And the movie's not real.
Why do people want this falcon?
It's rare.
Okay.
And it's the stuff that dreams are made of.
You made up that last part, didn't you?
No, that's what he says.
No kidding. Someone actually says that about the Maltese Falcon?
Yeah, Bogart says it.
Oh, that's awesome.
See? So the MacGuffin is the stuff that dreams are made of in the Maltese Falcon.
Very good.
Does he say of or on?
Who says on?
What do you make a dream on? What?
The stuff the dreams are made on. Oh, like the table? You lay out
the dream workshop. The workbench for dreams. All right, good.
I forget why they want it. I think it's just worth money.
Well, that to me is a sign of, and that's a famous MacGuffin, Kelly Wand. I like your choice. But if it's not clear, like, why people want it, I tend to think that that's kind of a weakness. Let me look at mine. Does that work for mine? I think in all of mine, it's clear why well, I don't know. We'll see where that goes.
You always have a qualifier that you hold back. It's like playing games with you at Chew Club.
Did I mention the rule?
Did I mention that unit can fly?
Dingus, what is your number three MacGuffin worth remembering?
All right. I've got two of my three MacGuffins worth remembering have musical cues that I'm going to give you guys.
Hmm. Are you going to sing?
Yeah, I'm going to hum.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a little musical cue.
All right. Awesome. Oh, Close Encounters.
In the Loop.
Go ahead, Dingus. Give us your song.
Should I, or do you guys just want to guess every movie in the world like you did with my war movies? Tom, Kelly, I think you've given Tom Tourette's or something. I'm not sure what happened.
What?
I caught Tourette's from Kelly Wand. It's true.
Huh. Didn't know that was contagious. I know it was airborne.
It's gone airborne. All right, here's my musical cue for my number three memorable MacGuffins for this week. 3x3. Ready?
Jurassic Park.
1941.
I know, yeah, like I know that's
40s music.
Benny Goodman, yeah.
It was in like 9 million movies, so it's the worst clue ever.
Yeah, that's really a bad clue.
It's in every World War II movie with the Andrews sisters.
It's a song that the song I was attempting to hum is something called American Bandstand. Have you ever heard that song?
With Dick Clark.
Yeah.
How old do you think we are, dude? What's wrong
with
you?
Is this the guy who picked? Well, never mind.
Yeah. Touche. One, two, three.
All right, then I'll give you a line, you losers. You ready for the line?
Did you really think we were going to be able to guess it from singing that song?
No, I just wanted to do it.
Oh, okay. Because I feel awfully thick. Okay, give us the line.
All right, ready?
Yeah.
I don't give a fuck about your war or your president.
Oh, because you know it's the tape.
He has to find the president's finger.
Yeah. Hey, diagram to the bridge.
That's a great MacGuffin.
All right, so my third favorite MacGuffin is from the movie Escape from New York, a 1981 movie directed by Mr. John Carpenter.
Now your music cue's good. I like your music cue now.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And I like this because for me, and this is where I'm going to make you not like me, I think there's sort of a little bit of a double MacGuffin in this film. And so that he first has to find the president, and then he has to take care of the tape. And one of the things that I went with on this when I was thinking about MacGuffins that are memorable for me are MacGuffins that turn out to be – that seem to be really important to somebody and seem to drive the plot for a while but turn out to be rather meaningless or impotent. And both the way the president turns out and, of course, the way the tape – what the tape turns out to be – or what they find, turns out to be rather meaningless. And I love Escape from New York. It's one of the earliest movies I remember seeing on Laserdisc when I was too young to watch this movie. It was one of those things that my parents and another set of parents said, here, watch this movie. And they went off to do their thing. And I was horrified by Escape from New York and also just fascinated by it. And I love the idea of the president, finding the president, and then getting the tape across that bridge.
I think any good MacGuffin, though, like Kelly's with Maltese Falcon and like some of the other ones we'll talk about, will have a twist like that, though, Dingus. I think part of a MacGuffin is that it's not what it seems.
Well, that did have a twist in Escape from New York.
Well, so I almost picked Escape from New York. The reason I didn't is I still don't understand. So he gets Donald Pleasance out of there. He gets the president. Why do they need the tape as well? Why can't
they
president...
need the tape. They don't actually need Donald Pleasance. That's what I thought. They actually need the tape more.
Right. The tape is a very important cassette tape about nuclear fusion.
Right. But what is it a tape of? Is it Donald Pleasance on the tape?
No. It's you know, why Donald Pleasance thinks at the end is kind of goofy because he says he has something about this is why I escaped, and he's going to play it for everybody. But he's going to this peace conference, and they're in the middle of a war. He's going to this peace conference with this tape about nuclear fusion, and this is going to somehow resolve the conflict. This is going to bring world peace or somehow resolve the war in some way. And at the end, he plays it, and it's American Bandstand.
Which caused world peace. Snake Plissken outsmarted them all. Because we know in the sequel that there was peace.
Oh, that's right. Because that's kind of like a nihilistic ending, is to sabotage the peace talks with Kathy's tape.
So Snake saved the world accidentally. But
oops. Well, kind of like Anakin Skywalker accidentally destroyed the Death Star thing in Phantom Menace.
Well, midichlorians were firing the
point.
Through his fingers.
Well, Snake doesn't care about any of that, and he gets back there at the end, and he asks the president, after all this, how he feels about those people sacrificing themselves, and the president's like, yeah, that's great. And so Snake realizes that, you know, he's right.
Nothing's changed, right.
President of what?
Ah.
A lot of good people died getting you out.
The second one could have been good.
We thought you were dead. Let's just do the Escape from New York line. The second one, they didn't make a second one, Kelly Wine. I don't know if you're aware of that. Yeah, that's true.
He served with Peter Fonda.
No, it didn't happen.
All right.
Escape from Queens.
President's daughter, very important. Turns off electricity. Gotcha.
All right, Tom, what's your number three?
My number three is a movie that I didn't care for, mainly because Julia Roberts scares the Dickens out of me.
Oh, I almost picked this. This is great.
So Duplicity is presumably about Clive Owen and Julia Roberts chasing a formula, basically industrial espionage. And it's Tony Gilroy. He wrote and directed it. And I love Tony Gilroy. So I just blame everything wrong about this movie on Julia Roberts. She's just terrible. She's got no chemistry with Clive Owen. And to me, though, the emotional core of this movie are Tom Wilkinson and Paul Giamatti as the heads of these two competing pharmaceutical companies. So it's all about the industrial espionage, and, you know, there's something going on with the two of them. As a matter of fact, the movie peaks early on with this amazing slow motion fight scene between Paul Giamatti and Tom Wilkinson. It would go in my list of like top 10 fight scenes of all time. It's just two middle-aged men just wailing away on each other. They're supposed to be shaking hands, negotiating something, and it's just a slow motion, basically CEO slap fight. But what happens in the course of this movie is that, you know, there's a magic formula. And I'm watching the movie, and I'm not really caring about what's going on, what the stakes. I'm kind of lost. But then at one point, it comes time for them to reveal what the magical formula is. And watching it, I'm like, what, these are pharmaceutical companies. You know, I guess it's going to be the cure for cancer or something like that. But it turns out that one of the companies has hit on the cure for baldness.
What?
And I was like, oh, you know what, that's kind of a big deal. Yeah, you know, okay, I think the stakes have been raised. That makes sense. And there's this subtext that they don't really push, but it's there. Anybody watching it knows that it's there. Tom Wilkinson's company supposedly has discovered this. And, of course, Paul Giamatti's company wants it.
Because he's bald.
Exactly, and Paul Giamatti is bald. So the twist, of course, is that it's a big – I'm going to ruin the movie. So stop listening. Fast forward real quick if you're going to see Duplicity. The twist, of course, is that he has no such formula. It's all a fake out to make him think that he has the formula.
Gotcha.
But I love that, you know, if you're going to do something with pharmaceutical companies and not go for the crazy, overdramatic, they've cured cancer, then you know what? Yeah, curing baldness, that's, wow, okay, that works. So that's my number three, Duplicity.
That's very good. That's very good. I was close on that one. Very nice.
I didn't see that one.
I don't necessarily recommend it.
I saw Closer. That was the movie that made me like Julia Roberts.
There's stuff in Duplicity I really like. There's filmmaking craft in that movie that is really quite good. And in fact, when I was sitting there watching it, there was one moment in particular where I just thought, God, I love movies. I just love movies. And he knows how to make a movie. But Tom's right. Ultimately, the lack of chemistry makes the movie fall apart. But there's stuff in there that really, really works.
I think Tony Gilroy has – I think he needs to stop hanging around with Steven Soderbergh's buddies. Like Michael Clayton with, say, Daniel Day-Lewis instead of George Clooney would have been phenomenal. Or anybody other than Julia Roberts, who had some chemistry with Clive Owen, I think would have helped Duplicity remarkably. Get away from all of Soderbergh's stooges.
Yeah, I don't know. Aside from two glaring moments in Michael Clayton, I don't have a problem with George Clooney. Two glaring moments make it difficult, but I don't think he's. I don't think he ruins the movie, but he ruins those two moments. And I guess you're right. I guess that does knock the film down a star.
Star,
so to speak.
We have ratings now.
I'm thinking Netflix stars when I say that.
Oh,
all right, Kelly Wand. What is your number two memorable MacGuffin?
My number two memorable MacGuffin is Zapped with Heather Thomas's boobs. So it's
Stop
two
it.
MacGuffins. All right, I'm just kidding. My number two is one where the main character is the MacGuffin, but you don't know it.
Can I guess it?
Yeah.
Are you going to do – is the main character – are her initials MJ?
What?
Oh, never mind. Okay.
What was yours?
Spider-Man?
I don't want to say – because it might be on someone's list.
No.
Should MJ? I say? Should I say? Did that ruin it for anybody else?
Michael Jackson?
I was thinking of Fifth Element, where it turns out that Mila Jovovich is the Fifth Element.
Well, love is the Fifth Element, so in a way –
Love is the Seventh Wave.
So, okay, what's yours, Kelly Wand? I'm sorry.
Mine was No Way Out with Kevin Costner. Gesundheit. What the hell was that? Did you just knock a spoon into a mug? Empire of the Sun. Yeah, remember No Way Out with the one where he's like the Navy dude and they're trying to make this picture of him come into focus?
That's on a couple of my possible 3x3 lists, so don't explain too much. I am totally befuddled by what you're talking about, her being a MacGuffin, though.
Well,
you're talking about me or Kelly Wand?
I'm talking about Kelly Wand.
What do you mean, her? It's him. It's Kevin Costner.
Oh, I thought you meant her. I thought you... Oh, well, I went with Tom saying her with MJ. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, what was MJ?
Mila Jovovich.
Oh, yeah.
Is the fifth element.
Lelou Dallas Multipass.
Lelou. Well, yeah, love was the fifth element, though. I mean, she was half of the fifth element. Bruce Willis was also part of the fifth element.
Ah, okay.
They loved each other. Because that's when they kissed. Never mind. Anyway, No Way Out. They're looking for Yuri, the Russian spy. It turns out he's the Russian spy. He's on Shutter Island. Abe Lincoln is the Civil War.
Does No Way Out hold up?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
But Baby's Day Out also has a baby. He's the MacGuffin.
There's always four in every 3x3 for Kelly. It's,
well,
he's
six.
Really the...
Yeah, out of Thomas's boobs. That's fine.
Who directed No Way Out? Is that Roger Donaldson? Or did I just make that up?
Is that a dude?
I don't think so.
It's got to be John McTiernan.
No, we don't know. Okay.
Joel Schumacher?
Stop.
Now we're just guessing. That's all right.
It was Roger Donaldson. Damn. Huh. We laughed at Tom, and he was right.
That's right. There you go. I know my Donaldson.
Hey, Tom, what's 10 to the 0th power?
Zero?
Ah, that's what I thought. No, it's 1. Okay, good. You're as dumb as I am.
That's math. I can't be bothered to answer.
Oh, yeah. Knocked out 10 to the 4th time.
All right, so No Way Out, good, which doesn't hold up and which was directed by Roger Donaldson. Okay.
Well, I had to change it to that because you ruined my Repo Man.
Oh, okay. You were really going to pick Repo
No, actually, that's not my real number two. My real number two is...
Stop!
Dingus, what is your real number two?
All right, as is my wont, I'm going to give you a line this time.
You're not going to... You don't have a musical cue.
No, my number one has a musical cue. Okay. I'm just waiting for one of you two to spoil it. All right, but my number two has a line cue.
Okay.
And this is one of my favorite lines ever.
Hey, Kelly Wand, he's going to do a Star Wars line.
Oh, God, I hope not.
I know. Why? Okay, sorry, Dingus, go ahead.
He hasn't in a while. It's been a long time.
Yeah, but when he's talking about, like, his favorite lines ever, I'm sure one of his favorite lines ever has got to be some Star Wars thing.
Star Wars has no good dialogue, though, really.
I know. Don't tell him, though. Don't tell him.
He doesn't know, yeah.
You'll break his heart. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dingus. We had you on hold for a second. Okay, go. Give us a line from your number two MacGuffin worth remembering.
From Star Wars.
Commander, I want those plans and I want them now!
That's a great line. Who's saying that exactly? Was that George Washington?
Apology accepted, Admiral Ozel. Huh.
Okay, go ahead, Dingus.
I was going to do a Yoda voice, but you guys preempted me. No Yoda voice for you. All right, here's the line, you crapheads. So shines a good deed in a weary world.
Willy Wonka?
Thank you very much.
Gobstopper was the... Yes.
The Everlasting Gobstopper is one of my favorites.
That's a good one, yeah.
And once again, that is an object that turns out to not to – it matters because it's refused. And
right.
I don't even know that the film – and I don't know the book, but I'm just going to deal with the film – resolves whether or not the Everlasting Gobstopper is a real thing as it is claimed to be. But as a MacGuffin, it's beautiful for me because by choosing to do the right thing – Charlie wins everything, and the moment I go crazy when I think about this moment in this line, the moment where Charlie puts it down on the table and Gene Wilder's hand just goes over it and covers it. And he says, "So shines a good deed in a weary world," just drives me crazy. I just get chills even thinking about that moment. Now, the only problem for me is that, as far as I'm concerned, there's never any doubt that Charlie's going to do the right thing. There's never any doubt because of who Charlie is and how he's set up that he's going to do it. He's an absolute good as far as I'm concerned in this movie. He makes a mistake that Willy Wonka berates him for. But no matter what Willy Wonka does, no matter how mean or crazy or dark it gets, I don't think there's any doubt that Charlie's going to do the right thing. But nevertheless, this MacGuffin is beautiful for me because of that little moment.
It looks cool, too. Yeah, like you want to eat it. You're dying to know what it tastes like. Like, well, why does everyone want this in their mouths?
Isn't it just a big gumball kind of thing?
Well, no, it's got spikes on it.
In the remake, it's a big gumball, which I think is more true to how it's described in the book. But in Willy Wonka, it looks like sort of a little, I don't know,
Oompa Loompa scrotum.
Or Oompa Loompa scrotum, or some sort of atom with different things shooting off of it. So it looks kind of like an interesting little sprocket.
It looks like poison. It looks like a poisonous peyote button.
But it turns out to be really nothing at all other than a chance for the hero of this show to show he has integrity.
It's not nothing at all to Slugwarts.
Well.
Hogwarts.
Well, Hogwarts is another MacGuffin, actually.
Ugh. Do we have to talk about those movies? I liked your MacGuffins.
Thanks, MacGuffin-y.
That's a good one. Okay. My number two MacGuffin worth remembering is from a movie called Running Scared that did not feature Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines. This is the Paul Walker Running Scared. So the MacGuffin in this movie...
Oh, that Australian actor you like.
I love me some Paul Walker after this movie. And I actually have seen, I'm pretty sure, all of his movies. And that means things like Eight Below... There's a movie he did that was kind of like
Tammy and the T-Rex with Denise Richards when they're really young.
Paul Walker's in that?
Yeah.
Oh, rats, I got to Netflix that now. Okay, Tammy and
the Jessica Alba swimming.
Yeah.
Actually, Into the Blue is not bad.
She swims a lot in it.
Into the Blue really is not bad. I'm serious. I'm saying this unironically.
It's not good though.
I didn't say that. It's not bad.
It's sea level.
But Running Scared is indubitably good. So Running Scared, the MacGuffin, is a gun used in a drug deal that's gone bad where some cops get killed. Now, of course, you're going to have the mob chasing the gun and the cops chasing the gun. But that's not what this movie is content to do. That's in there. But the movie is more about it plays on a child accidentally getting a hold of the gun. And it based on, you know, a child's fascination with guns, an abused boy uses this gun as sort of the means to go down this violent rabbit hole of a story, very, very kind of Alice in Wonderland. And then based on that, the good guys are chasing him and the gun, and the gun goes through multiple hands. It gets used in multiple instances.
So it's like the cat in Cat's Eye.
Don't remember Cat's Eye. Is that the anthology thing with Harvey Keitel?
It's an anthology, and Drew Barrymore like fights a troll in it, like a miniature troll. Never mind.
She starts things on fire.
The Ledge. Remember Robert Hayes on The Ledge?
Do not.
Never mind. James Woods quit smoking. You remember that? Okay, let's get back to yours.
Nope, so I'm done with mine. So that's my number two is Running Scared and the gun in that.
It wouldn't be a 3x3 without Tom fantasizing about Paul Walker's pecs.
I played around with Running Scared in my head, but I was thinking about the bullet, and then I just said, oh, no, I'm going to get off of that.
Well, where does the bullet come from?
Exactly.
The gun. Because if you remember Paul Walker, well, I don't want to say too much about, and it's got a similar thing, too. It's got a twist, but Paul Walker's hiding this gun, and then an abused boy next door takes the gun to shoot his abusive father. And then the bullet sails through the abusive father back into Paul Walker's house, and the cops come out.
Right.
So the gun causes all kinds of problems. And then he runs off with the gun, and so Paul Walker has to find him to find the gun. I need to see that again. I love that movie.
Me too. I think we should have a film festival where we watch that for the group of people.
I think we should have a Paul Walker film festival, frankly. And that should be the bookend. That should be the first movie and the last movie we watch. And we can see Eight Below. We can see Into the Blue. We can see all the Fast and Furious except one
of them.
Lucas Black. I know Lucas Black took over for one of them.
Wasn't he play Jeep Hansen too?
Well,
Josh Lucas. black.
Running Scared reminded me of another movie, and I almost picked that, but I'm not going to mention it in case either one of you have it.
Okay.
But I'll mention it.
Is it Red Sun with Charles Bronson, where he's going for the samurai sword?
Is that your number one pick, Kelly Wand?
No.
What is your number one pick?
My number one pick of MacGuffins is a movie that's way before your times, and you won't care.
You know what? You might have stolen my pick, you jerk.
I don't think so. I don't think you've seen this.
Well, I watched one today specifically for this.
Is it a Western?
Oh, whew, no. Okay, I'm in
the... Of course not.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
All right, Western.
The one I'm thinking of that Running Scared remind me of is a Western.
What? Which one?
I'm not going to tell you. You go ahead and make your pick.
Yeah, you got a Western now, Kelly Wand. You don't want Dingus to scoop you.
All right, my number one MacGuffin Western was The Searchers.
That's it.
Is that what you're thinking?
Nicely done, Kelly Wand.
The reason it's cool is because he's trying to find Natalie Wood, who's kidnapped by Indians, John Wayne. Move the John Wayne part of that sentence to the beginning where it belongs. Fix that post.
Strike that. Reverse it.
But anyway, the reason she is a quality MacGuffin is because he's initially looking for her so he can save her from her heathen savage captors. But he takes years to find her, and by then she's gotten hot and nubile, and then he wants to find her so he can kill her because she's been desecrated by the red man. So the reason for finding the MacGuffin changes. But the MacGuffin just keeps getting hotter.
You know, if I was going to be a stickler, and I'm not, but I don't know that the MacGuffin. That works, though. I love The Searchers, and I love that twist, but I don't think she's a MacGuffin because the audience cares about her. She's a character. You know,
the not caring thing, I don't think, is a real MacGuffin term.
It is. A crucial part of the MacGuffin, of the idea of a MacGuffin, is that it has no emotional resonance with the audience. It gives the good guy and a bad guy a reason to chase something. And you know what? It can go all kinds of ways, but I don't think in the traditional classification of a MacGuffin, Natalie Wood works. But since I love The Searchers, you know what, Kelly Wand? I'm not going to disqualify that. The judges will let that one stand.
Wikipedia says sometimes the MacGuffin is even forgotten by the end of the film, but not always.
Right. I'm afraid you including, which Wikipedia also does, you including Tom, the Ark of the Covenant sort of scuttles a lot of your...
Why? Who in the audience cares about the Ark of the Covenant?
Everybody, and it figures prominently.
Everybody? It's just a device.
Monsters.
It could be replaced by the Hand of Vecna. It could be replaced by one of Moses' tablets. It could be replaced... If the MacGuffin is something that is just completely... That can easily be replaced by something else that has no intrinsic... like value to the plot, if it's just a doodad that you can stick some other doodad in there.
Like Noah's Ark of the Covenant.
Exactly, right. There you go.
That's not what the Hebrews thought. I'm sorry.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, Dingus, Raiders of the Lost Ark is not about the Hebrews. It's about an archaeologist. He could be looking for...
It doesn't matter. The Ark of the Covenant upsets the balance of this.
Why?
It just does.
Well, no one knows what it does. So, in a way, Tom.
Yeah. Why do you care about the Ark of the Covenant? Why does it? Seriously, though, Dingus. Why does? And I admit, I could be wrong. You have to explain to me why would the audience actually care about the Ark of the Covenant versus some other, like random ancient artifact?
Let me ask this: when they opened the Ark of the Covenant, did you care what was going to happen?
Yeah.
But that's not – I didn't care about the Ark
itself. Did you care what was inside when they opened the Ark of the Covenant?
No. I cared about what was going to happen.
And you're
Harris,
the only one.
Bart, and Karen Allen. I cared about the characters and not the thing that they cared about.
Why don't they just leave it open? Kill everybody.
My concern for the Ark of the Covenant was once removed. I cared about it because they cared about it. If they weren't part of the equation, it wouldn't have mattered to me.
I'm afraid that you're the only one who wasn't curious when they took the lid off the
Ark. That's why I cared. I was curious, of course, because the movie was built around what's inside, what's it going to do, what's going to happen. Of course I was curious, and of course I wanted to know what was going to happen.
But I didn't
have any emotional connection to the Ark of the Covenant. Just like I don't have any emotional connection to the gun that Oleg used, or the cure for baldness, or the tape from the president's peace thing, or the everlasting gobstopper, or the Maltese Falcon, or Kevin Costner. That right there is the list. I don't have any emotional connection to those things. The only reason they matter is because the characters care about them. And that's the case with the Ark of the Covenant.
Would you submit that there are people who would have an emotional connection to the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, of course. There are people who have emotional connection to guns, to cures for baldness, to tapes from peace conferences, and to everlasting gobstoppers.
So you're going to equate
in that
the
order.
Ark of the Covenant being opened to a cure for baldness and a gun?
I'm going to... Well, yes, I'm going to equate MacGuffins as far as the narrative. Hold on, Dingus. As far as
that's all I needed to know.
Dingus, as far as the narrative purpose that they serve, yes, they are identical. Now, if you want to talk about their existence outside of their narrative purpose, then we're no longer talking about a MacGuffin. We're no longer talking about a narrative device.
Exactly, and that's what I would say is the Ark of the Covenant. But it's fine. But all I'm saying is to arguing along Kelly's lines is valid because I think that the initial inclusion of Ark of the Covenant while in the Wikipedia list upsets the balance. That's all I'm saying.
Upsets the balance of what, though? I don't understand what this balance is that you think is upset.
Upsets the balance of the rules you're setting down for MacGuffin. I think it's a different thing.
Well, it's an arbitrary rule that it has to be something inconsequential.
No. I'm not. First of all, it's not my rule. It's the way that people traditionally think of a MacGuffin. Now, you guys want to change that, and that's fine.
No, I don't want to change that. I want to say that Ark of the Covenant doesn't apply. I'm not changing the rules. I'm saying that example doesn't apply, and you including it and Wikipedia including it means that Kelly's inclusion of the Searchers things is fine.
Yeah, Tom.
I have no problem with Kelly's inclusion of the Searchers things because you guys can do with the list as you will. But you cannot willy-nilly redefine what a MacGuffin means.
Yeah, Kelly.
I agree, and I don't think Ark of the Covenant applies. And you do. That's fine.
I still don't understand why you think, because it matters to Jews?
No, because it matters to us, and it matters in the resolution of the plot. By the end, we don't care usually we don't care, or the MacGuffin has turned out to be inconsequential.
You don't care about
the Ark of the Covenant turns out to be very consequential to this and is the keystone of what's going on there.
Let me table this discussion after your number one, because my number one, I think, will have a thing or two to say about this. So let's go to your number one, Dingus.
Wait, my actual number one was The Glass of Water and Real Men.
Will you stop it?
All right, so Dingus, what's your number one? And give us a musical cue. I understand you're going to sing for us.
Yes, I am. I'm going to sing for you guys. Are you ready?
Yes.
I don't even know if I can think of the theme now that I got all worked up.
Just do Jurassic Park.
All right, you guys ready?
Yep.
Da-dum, 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 da-dum.
For a minute, I was thinking Bridge Over the River Kwai, but that's a different war march thing. That's it.
The bridge is a MacGuffin, right?
No, you're both.
That's
pirates.
From Die Hard 3, so it's Fort Knox.
Why is he doing When Johnny Comes Marching Home? Because I don't recall that from Star Wars.
Yeah, or Raiders. So it can't be a movie.
I don't know what movie has When Johnny Comes Marching Home. Is it Kelly's Heroes?
Nope, it is a war movie though.
Oh, Three Kings? Well, no, they don't sing.
Guns of Navarone. Things are great.
It's been in a lot of movies, but for some reason, whenever I think of this movie, I think of When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again.
You're going to have to give us a line.
I'm not going to give you a line. You should
give
be able
us
to know.
Musical cue.
You just admitted it was in a bunch of movies. I don't know what movies have When Johnny Comes Marching Home that have a MacGuffin. The Searchers.
Yes, it's The Searchers. It's
if
from
it was River Kwai, he would have done that other song.
No, I know. That was just me being unable to identify songs when I hear them. I don't know, Dingus. You got me. I'm stumped.
It's Species. From a 1964 movie.
Oh. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove. Thank you very much, Kelly Wand. Hmm.
Is it the number to the Pentagon or the number to what is Peter Sellers trying to get the phone number for to the White House?
It's the code.
Quarter.
Right. The callback code. The recall.
Code.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good. The recall code that Group Captain Lionel Mandrake is trying to get from General Jack D. Ripper, and that the entire army rolls in to fight the base of Jack D. Ripper is trying to get, and that he eventually has to go. That he eventually has to futz about with Colonel Bat Guano, if that really is his name, to get that code back to the White House
so that they can recall the bombers, and which is such a great, for me, a great MacGuffin again, because it's used in a one of my favorite Coen Brothers films, in sort of a cursory way. And I just love this little thing. It's a little MacGuffin. We care about it. He's got to get it. He tries a number of strategies to get Jack Ripper to give him the code, and he finally finds it out, and it turns out to make no difference whatsoever. And so that's my number one.
What Coen Brothers riffs on the recall code?
I know Intolerable Cruelty was your favorite.
In Raising Arizona, in the bathroom, when the brothers are about to steal the station wagon, it's graffitied on the walls.
Good Lord. Wow. Do you know the number, Dingus? Could you tell us?
It's not a number. It's OPE or POE. It's some permutation of purity of essence. It's not a number. It's a code. It's a three-letter code, and they have to find out the code. And so I went back and forth about, first I thought of Failsafe, which is a movie I really love, and which is famously entwined with Dr. Strangelove. And they're trying to find the code and working out the code for recalling the bombers. And it is, I think, a numerical code. There's a numerical code in Failsafe. It's been a while since I've seen it.
Both times it fails.
Yeah, and then I thought about Dr. Strangelove and how absurd it turns out to be, and how it is just this silly three-letter code that really is useless.
Well, now, isn't it useless because the B-52 gets shot up by a Russian fighter? Is that correct?
Exactly. Well, it doesn't get shot up. I think it's like a concussion from a surface-to-air missile, or not a surface-to-air, but it's an explosion that causes their instruments to go out.
Right.
Wet.
So if that explosion hadn't happened, the code would have worked, though.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. All right. Good. Good. Well, man, I'm surprised none of you guys picked mine, because my number one, which I just watched this today. This movie's from 1955, and it's one of those classics that is not very good until it gets to what it does, at which point it is awesome. But I think this is one of the early MacGuffins, and what I didn't know and why I wanted to watch this is the MacGuffin for Repo Man, Pulp Fiction, and Raiders of the Lost Ark is drawn very blatantly, and it's so obvious watching this movie, from Kiss Me Deadly. Do you guys know about this?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen this movie?
Yeah.
I saw it in a theater. It's great.
It's not great, though. It's really dated, and the guy playing Mike Hammer, it's based on a Mickey Spillane, Mike Hammer thing, and it has apparently nothing to do with the book, which is awesome. The guy playing Mike Hammer is like Ralph Meeker, or something like that.
Baker, yeah.
He's terrible. Oh, my God, he's such a jerk, and he's wooden, and I'm like, what?
Cloris Leachman gets killed in it.
Cloris Leachman is like, she's supposed to be the sexy hot chick, and she looks exactly like she looks when she's 50 years old. And it's terrible. This movie is so stupid, and it's just this standard plotting, methodical detective noir thing. And this is the thing about a lot of detective noir stuff, and some MacGuffins, is that in these noir things, the detective's looking for something, and he may not even know what he's looking for. So you don't know what they're looking for in Kiss Me Deadly until, you know, maybe an hour, 20 minutes in. It's only the last 20 minutes that it's clear that he has a key to a locker, and there's a box in this locker, and someone says to him, this is the only backstory, by the way, about what's going on with this and why it's out there and what it is his sort of insidious contact once says to him, I'm going to say three words to you, and if those three words mean something to you, you will understand what this is about. And now I'm going to screw this up. He says, because they're not worried. I'm going to say three things to you. And he says, Manhattan Project, Trinity, and something else. I forget. But obviously they're referencing, you know, that it's a nuclear device.
I think you're a MacGuffin.
So Mike Hammer goes to, and he finds this box. And he even gets, so his secretary, his sort of girl Friday who helps him, who he ends up rescuing, at one point has a great monologue where she berates him for, exactly, Velda, for chasing the great what's it, which is amazing because she's like, you men are always chasing your great what's it's.
Weapons.
Exactly, exactly.
Unobtainium.
So he finds this box that's wrapped in leather, and he undoes the leather, and there's a metal box inside of it. And he touches it, and he says, oh, it's hot. And he starts to open it, and suddenly Kiss Me Deadly becomes a science fiction movie. Because the moment he starts to open it, this incredibly bright light comes out of it, and it makes this weird, like, demon hissing breathing noise, and it burns his flesh on his arm until he closes it down real quick. And I was watching that going like, what the fuck? It was the most random damn thing to have that happen in this otherwise pedestrian L.A. noir detective story. So from here, we go on to the box gets the bad guy gets the box, and the femme fatale who has crossed him kills the bad guy, and she's going to open the box to see what's in it. And she does, and there's light everywhere, and there's the demon hissing sound, and she bursts into flames. You know, this box makes her explode. And that totally made me think of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so Mike Hammer and Velda rush out of the house, and behind them, the house, some huge explosion destroys the house. I don't know if it's reached critical mass or if it's going to be a nuke or... There's no telling what, because it's one of these things that while the house is blowing up and they're struggling to get away from it, it's a beach house, and for some reason they've run out into the surf to get away from it, suddenly the words "the end" come up. And there's nothing else said. And it's just the weirdest thing is that this detective movie becomes this science fiction horror movie about a killer box. Obviously they were thinking of the Cold War and of nuclear warfare. And they even mention several times these mythological. They talk about Lot's wife and the head of the Medusa in Pandora's box. So the villain sort of has a monologue about that at the end. And when the femme fatale crosses him and kills him, he says to her, "There's this weird line about I implore you as if I were the three heads of Cerberus. Do not cross this line." I mean, it's the weirdest thing. No, I implore you as if I were the three heads of Cerberus. Do not open the box. And then she shoots him and opens the box and bursts into flame.
You shall not pass.
Should listen to Cerberus. Cerberus.
But so this dingus, I mean, the thing about the audience never cared about what was in the box. By the time it's over, it turns out that what is in the box is powerful and it can destroy people and burn them and blow up this beach house. You know, we don't know what it is. We don't know if it's religious or supernatural or strictly scientific. None of that is really explained, but it is important and it is powerful. But we don't have an emotional attachment to it necessarily. It reminds me very much of the Ark of the Covenant as far as how this is a huge, important thing. It doesn't have the cultural significance, of course, of the Ark of the Covenant, but it has just as much power. And this woman opening the box... And then they just, you know, it's 1955, so they can't do too much fancy stuff. There's a shot of her opening the box and then just shrieking like she's in a horror movie. And in the foreground, they superimpose just fire. You know, they took a picture of fire and they composited it over her. But then they do a cut of Mike Hammer running out of the room, and there's a dummy sitting in front of the open box they've lit on fire that's just standing there stationary as if it's just opened the box that's just, like, burning while he runs out of the room. But you can tell they very much wanted to do something like Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you see her fate, her anguished face, and then the flames burning her.
Like Cate Blanchett in the fourth Raiders movie.
Right, where they just had to recycle their ideas.
And, right.
So I just was astonished. Kiss Me
Deadly. You don't like that movie? You don't like Kiss Me Deadly?
No, not really. Well, you know what? I like it for the ending. It's one of those movies that because it did this really weird thing. And, oh, Kelly Wand, I wished I had not known that was happening. Like, I knew there was going to be some weird thing with the glowing box, but if I didn't know that was going to be in there, that just would have been amazing.
Yeah.
Surprised like that. But no, that Ralph Meeker is terrible. And there's just so much, like, dated detective work, and this is kind of cool. He has an answering machine. It's 1955, and I think it may be the world's first answering machine. He's got a big old tape to tape real thing. It's mounted on the wall, and he screens his calls.
Huh. You know what? I think I'm going to have to come around all of a sudden on the Ark of the Covenant, because I'm thinking of the end of the movie now, and for all intents and purposes, the government, and this is sort of the message of the movie, and when I was getting so passionate, I kind of missed it. The government turns it into a MacGuffin for all intents and purposes.
Right.
Because they box it, and the whole, that closing scene is Steven Spielberg sort of telling us, hey,
MacGuffin.
Yeah. So, yeah, with as passionate and excited as I got about how different the Ark of the Covenant is, I think I'm going to have to recant and say, yeah, you're probably right. Oh, well.
Well, but there definitely are cases, like even if we grant that, like for instance with Fifth Element, where Bruce Willis and Milla Jovovich are the MacGuffins, you know, we care about them, but they're still very much MacGuffins with the good guys and the bad guys are chasing, you know, it's what everybody's after. I mean, it's not a hard and fast rule, and what constitutes how much you care certainly varies.
No, but it's clear that Spielberg knows what he's doing there, and I think that what he's doing is sort of showing that.
Right, throwing it away, yeah.
Right, and part of it is a statement about government, but part of it is a statement about movie making too.
Right.
Top men.
You know, a drink.
What was Top Men? Was that a Raiders reference?
Yeah.
Where like top men are taking care of it? What was the line?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're good. Yeah.
Very good.
Top men. He goes, who? Top men. And then he calls them ignorant fools or something.
Fools. Bureaucratic fools.
Bureaucratic fools.
All right. Well, Kelly Wand, you, can you top that as far as a three by three? Oh, yep. Oh, should we go by for rejected ones that didn't make the list?
I just want to know if there were any that you guys felt bad about passing up.
I wanted to pick Lord of the Rings, but I realized that I didn't care about the ring and that it was a book and not a movie. The ring wasn't that memorable. I mean, the ring's famous, but, you know, it's a ring. It's a piece of jewelry. And it's so retconned anyway, where Tolkien wrote Hobbit and then decided, oh, I'm going to make the ring something different than it was in that book.
I wanted to pick Aslan, but I'm a grown-up.
I want to ask if there's something you guys would have let me get away with, because it was on there until the very end.
All right.
And that's the plant from WALL-E.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, it's kind of memorable. Yeah, that's memorable. Yeah, yeah. I mean, as far as whether it's a MacGuffin or whether it's memorable.
No, I know it's memorable. I'm just wondering if you would have thought of it as a MacGuffin or of being more integral to the plot.
No, absolutely. I think that's a very good one.
All right.
You want to replace, say, Willy
Wonka?
There's nothing
I want to place. I'm you know, I worked on this and I had a hard time with this list. And then it started to fall into place. And this is one of the lovely things about 3x3. And if you really work on it all week, it's how it starts to fall into place and how you really start thinking about films and then you start making a list and crossing things off. And this one was quite wonderful. So I really had a good time with this.
I like the WALL-E one, Dingus, because it kind of represents like pregnancy and there's life in her tummy and that's part of the whole romance thing and they're robots. I like your WALL-E one. You know what? I like it better than Willy Wonka. Can I replace it for you?
Yeah, I thought you would, but the Gobstopper one just does it for me.
All right.
If 2001 has a MacGuffin, we're too stupid to understand as a species yet.
Is the obelisk a MacGuffin? No. Well, see, a lot of things like, and this is where if I were a stickler, like if I was y'all's professor at film school and I was trying to like inculcate you with traditional values, I would point out that some of these might not be MacGuffins because they're not traditionally movies where good guys and bad guys are chasing the same thing. For instance, in The Searchers, Kelly Wand, I mean, I like what you did with it, but there's no really bad guy chasing Natalie Wood. It's not...
No, John Wayne's the bad guy, too.
Well, right. He's the only one. It's about a searcher. It's about him rescuing her.
Yeah.
So traditionally, I think MacGuffins are at the center of people competing for something, of two parties or more.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. I was just saying that because I was sitting there wondering, could the MacGuffin in 2001 be an obelisk, that obelisk? But I don't think there is a MacGuffin in 2001.
The MacGuffin is the movie.
It's the MacGuffin a jumper.
Yeah. Everything you say, I hear three, one, two, three, after you say it.
Yeah.
You're amazing. You're like Neo for this podcast.
All right, Kelly, what do you got for us next week? Give us a great 3x3.
I don't have a great one, but I
have, come on, you must. Give us a...
I have an one. As in an banana. Three best depictions of drug use.
Depictions of drug use. Okay, do you need to elaborate by best or depiction or...
Prescription drugs count. It can be a state of mind or the whole or an entire sequence or the actual taking of the drug could be it or simply the mood of the movie.
Are you going to rule anything out like Tom did last week?
No, because I'm not a total dick.
See, the thing is, I just wanted to...
Accent on the total.
From doing the obvious stuff. Like, drug use, that's so broad that there's a lot to go with there. I just didn't... I knew Dingus was going to do The Ark. I knew Kelly Wand, you were going to do Pulp Fiction. I was just forcing you guys to be more entertaining, I hope.
That didn't work out.
I like y'all's picks. I thought I'm. There's nothing on here that I think should have been replaced with Raiders of the Lost Ark or Pulp Fiction.
Very nice.
All right, you can't do any Cheech and Chong. How's that?
Well, there goes my list.
Or Monty Python.
All right, stop talking.
All right, so join us for that next week. Three best depictions of drug use. And also join us. We will be seeing Greenberg, the Noah Baumbach movie with Ben Stiller. Have you guys seen the Zach Galifianakis Between Two Ferns with Ben Stiller plugging Greenberg?
No.
No. Isn't that spoilerish?
They do watch a clip from the... Well, they sort of... There's a clip from the movie involved, but it's safe to see if you were spoiler-averse like I am.
So it's safe for work.
It's safe for spoiler-sensitive.
If you don't watch it, it's perfect. We won't spoil anything. That's how good it is.
So I am Tom Chick. I am here with Christian Mersiniski?
McGuffney.
Christian Wu-Tang Morosky.
And also Kelly Wand.
I hate this podcast. Sometimes I try to do things, and it just doesn't work out the way I want it to. And I get real frustrated. And I try hard to do it, and I take my time, but it just doesn't work out the way I want it to. It's like I concentrate on real hard, but it just doesn't work out. And everything I do and everything I try, it never turns out. It's like I need time to figure these things out. There's always someone there going, hey, Mike, you don't even notice that you've been having a lot of problems lately, you know? Oh, Paul Walker, you're so buku.